Hi, my name's Jan Hyde. I've been asked to speak to you a little bit about my time in the military. I was in RAC Corps, so I'll talk a bit about that. Firstly, why did I join the military? Well, it wasn't actually my first choice employment. I started out as a high school teacher, but I was still very young at the time, and the challenge of teaching students who were only a year or so older than me was quite challenging. So I decided after looking at University Magazine that teaching in the military might be a little better for me, because I saw those students all in uniforms, all lined up neatly, looking very attentively in the photograph of the teacher. So I did apply to join the military as a teacher. They said, great, you'd make a good teacher in the military, but I'm sorry, we don't have any jobs for you, but do we have a deal for you? We'll send you to beautiful downtown Sydney, to George's Heights, overlooking Sydney Harbour, and we'll teach you to be an officer in the Women's Royal Australian Army Corps. Well, it sounded pretty good to me, so I signed up. So in July 1978, myself and 16 other women attended George's Heights for the first time. I'm very pleased to say that I'm still in contact with those women, and in fact we're planning our 40th anniversary reunion next year in Adelaide. So time at the RAC school was, as many people would know who've been in the military, a lot of marching around and yes sir, no sir, and attending classes. At that time, we were very fortunate though, women had just received equal pay. That was a significant achievement for women at the time. Prior to that, women had to leave the military when they were married, and they didn't get the opportunities that we had and that women have subsequently got, and I'll talk a bit about that as I go on. We spent the 6 months and we did learn a bit about military administration and military history, which was really excellent, and as I said, lots more marching around the playground. We did a bit of field work, but in those days we didn't have weapons. Women serving with weapons came a little bit later into my career. We did do an appreciation process. That was something that all officers have to learn as part of their junior officer training. Of course, the men at the officer training schools in Portsea and Duntroon, they did their military appreciation process about moving troops on the battlefields. But not for us. We did our military appreciation process on selecting a ball gown for our graduation. You can imagine that that's why things have changed quite a bit for us. Nowadays, women have very much the opportunity to put those troops on the ground and manage those troops on the ground. The ball gowns are a distant past. I graduated in December 1978 from RAC school as a second lieutenant into RAC Corps, but with an association with the Royal Australian Army Ordnance Corps. The Ordnance Corps is a logistics organisation that looks after a range of supply functions, but includes a number of other responsibilities for food provisions, armament and ammunition provisions. I had a range of roles in my time with the Royal Australian Army Ordnance Corps, and that included as a supply officer and as an administration officer. I had the great opportunity of travelling to all parts of Australia with postings around Sydney, Adelaide, Melbourne, Perth, and also into Brisbane, which was my hometown. Over the time that I served in the Royal Australian Army Ordnance Corps and the RAC Corps, we started to get an appreciation that women could be more integrated with men in the training. That started with our other ranks, our soldiers, and we commenced with having women at Kapooka. Following on from that, we integrated the women and the men in officer training. For some of us who'd done the basic 6 months training at RAC school, we had to undertake some additional training. We called it RAC-TAC, and it was for RAC women who needed to learn tactics, and with that, weapons handling. So we did that in around about 1981. But that was when we started to see a significant change in the role for women and the appreciation of what women could do in the military. I had a great range of postings in my time in the RAC, and that included in project management and in capital equipment procurement. I was fortunate enough to be responsible for procuring some of the major armaments that we still have in the Australian military today, including the rifle that all serving members have to learn to excel on as part of their basic training. One really excellent job that I had, which got me to appreciate the broadening roles that women are coming to, was looking after the pay cases for our other ranks. I was responsible for taking the Defence Force Remuneration Tribunal around to various parts of the, and this were, I should say, this were a group of civilians who had responsibility to determine the salary that a serving member would have for their particular trade. And I would take them to various experiences. We went out in the field with the artillery. We took them on board a Navy ship. We took them to Air Force bases and a whole range of different responsibilities to see what those serving members did, to see whether or not there were some genuine reasons for an increase in salary. During that time, we came across a couple of really interesting young women. One woman, her name was Daisy, and she was an Air Force sergeant. And she was an Air Force photographer. And she wasn't just a photographer on the ground, but she had a unique role as an aerial photographer. She worked at the Air Force Research Unit, in fact, in South Australia. And at the time, they would test the munitions from and the trajectories of the munitions as they were discharged from various aircraft. Now, in those days, to follow the trajectories, you needed to have a person holding a camera in the back of the aircraft and to follow the trajectory of the munitions. In the case of Daisy, she was a slight woman, but she would carry a massive camera in a very large case, and she would have to, while the aircraft was pulling all sorts of G's, forces of gravity, she would have to manipulate her body and follow the trajectory of this munitions out from the aircraft. It really was quite an arduous task, but she just thought, nope, part of the job, and she thoroughly enjoyed what she was doing. Another experience we had was meeting a young female corporal who was from the intelligence corps. She talked to the Remuneration Tribunal about her experiences working in Bougainville, where she was actually required to go out and develop relationships with the various tribes in Bougainville who were, as you may recall, warring tribes. And she had to go and make friends with the various tribes and build relationships with them and live with them and just gather intelligence about how they were working and what Australia could do to assist with the monitoring of the truce in Bougainville. Those are just two examples of what those women were doing at the time, and they certainly it demonstrated to the Remuneration Tribunal that they were worthy of the increases in salary that they were seeking. Of course, nowadays, women are getting even greater opportunities than Daisy and the corporal. We have females who are already major generals with significant responsibilities, admirals and air vice marshals in the respective services. They can fly aircraft of all types. They're now submariners. They serve in all sorts of roles in the military, that even they can now serve in the infantry if they can meet the necessary physical requirements, which I'm sure you realise are quite arduous, but it is achievable. We've got female engineers who are munitions, demolitions experts. They're just, the opportunities are so broad for women. The only areas that I'm aware of that women can't now serve in our special forces and our clearance divers in the Navy. But that's only a matter of time, I'm quite sure, quite confident that our women are very capable of doing that. As I said, that was one of the most eye-opening jobs that I had in my time in my early days in the military. Then an opportunity came, and my career advisor said to me, "Jan, we're considering you for a posting to Washington, D.C. And I said, "Oh, yes. How many people are you considering?" And they said, "Four." And I said, "How many women are you considering?" And they said, "One." And I thought, one in four, very little likelihood. I'm just a token person being considered. But as luck would have it, or hopefully ability, I was offered the opportunity and spent three wonderful years in Washington, D.C. as part of the Australian Embassy Joint Defence Staff. This job gave me a great opportunity to go to the Pentagon and liaise with my colleagues in the United States military. But I was also accredited, which is a term that said I was able to go to the Canadian Defence Force, so I would go to Ottawa and interact with my Canadian colleagues as well. What I was doing was trying to find out what we could learn from an Australian Defence point of view about how they manage their logistics and how they manage their personnel and what they do with their reservists, and share information about what we're doing in Australia, so that we could both improve how we could do things. Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the United States, and the United Kingdom are what we call Five Eyes group of countries where we experience a lot of commonality in what we do in terms of our military, even though our sizes are quite different. But we share that information to help improve ourselves and each other. In fact, the size of the military in the United States is vastly different. I think something like 15 times the size of the Australian Defence Force. Most often we hear that the United States Marine Corps, the closest to our Australian Defence Force, because the United States Marine Corps have their own ships and aircraft and land forces. While I was in Washington, D.C., it was a fairly challenging time for the United States because we had September the 11th. I fortunately, the day of September the 11th, I wasn't in the Pentagon where I had originally planned to have a meeting. I had instead invited my United States colleague to come across to the Australian Embassy in D.C. for the meeting. So I wasn't in the building at the time that, unfortunately, the aircraft had gone into the Twin Towers in New York and the other aircraft had gone into the side, Washington, D.C. But I did see an amazing change in Washington, D.C. in the course of that next 24 hours. At the time, we had the Prime Minister, John Howard, visiting Washington, D.C., and it was necessary to very quickly move him back to the embassy, and then he was moved on to an area that was safe for he and his wife to be for a period of time. We weren't sure exactly what was going on. But as can happen when you're by this time a lieutenant colonel female in an embassy, I was walking down the chancery, which is the big open area that we have at the embassy. We have a lot of functions there. And the ambassador, Michael Sawley, was walking down the chancery and he said, "Jan, could you just go and get the Prime Minister a cup of tea?" "The Prime Minister a cup of tea? Okay. Yes, I'm a Lieutenant Colonel and I can find a tea trolley and get the Prime Minister a cup of tea. Thanks, Jan. He's down in the basement. Oh, gosh. So what had happened, of course, we had two basements. The lower basement was for storage and the basement below that was for our working area where we had chippies and people who looked after the maintenance of the building. And that was the safest place in the short term to relocate the Prime Minister to. So I gathered together all the tea items and took them down and to the Prime Minister and said, cup of tea, Prime Minister? To which, of course, he was shocked, and because he was looking at a little television with graying screen, just wondering what the heck was going on in New York and Washington. But he took the cup of tea, and some years later, I met him again and reminded him of that experience. But he was concerned, as you could imagine, and it was at that point that we invoked the ANZUS Treaty, where Australia and the United States bond together. When one country is under threat, the other country becomes its strongest ally. And that ANZUS Treaty is as strong today as it's ever been. So from that, of course, we had a situation where our Australian troops were then committed to going into Afghanistan. But the events of the September the 11th certainly changed Washington, D.C. When I went to work, the morning I went to work, the morning of the Twin Towers and the Pentagon incident, it was a normal day in Washington, D.C. And, a nice day and people just getting on with life. By the time the 24 hours had passed when I eventually left the embassy, things had changed in D.C. We had watched the people, because they'd closed all the bridges, we watched the people leave Washington, D.C. on foot, and we were ringing around to make sure that we had accounted for all of our Australian personnel in Washington, because our personnel, we generally have around 300 to 400 Australian personnel plus their families on postings, undertaking training, etc., in the United States. And there was always the likelihood that someone was in New York at the time on taking their holidays. But we were able to account for all of our people, but we did note that we had two people in the Pentagon at the time of the incident, but both of them are subsequently found to be safe. But people left Washington, D.C., and the next day, when I left to go back home, everything had changed. Washington, D.C. had changed from a multicolour, vibrant city to red, white and blue. All I could see were red, white and blue flags everywhere. A lot of solemn people, and we had armoured personnel carriers on all of the street corners where, understandably, people needed to feel safe. We lived not far from the airport, and the airport was shut down, and for 6 weeks we didn't hear the sound of aircraft taking off. It was quite eerie. But as people do, people were very resilient, and after about 6 weeks or so, and most of the threat had passed from Washington and New York, we did see Washington, D.C. come back to life a bit, and our friends and our colleagues from our local area were very pleased to have Australians on board and by the United States side. 3 wonderful years in Washington, D.C., and I thought, well, time to go home to Brisbane. So I said to my poster, could I please get a posting back to Brisbane? And he said, you and 400 other lieutenant colonels. So I thought, well, there goes that opportunity. But he said, I've got a couple of jobs. Which one would you like? And he offered me a job as a commander in Tasmania. Little did I know that it was the first female commander in the 200 years of military in Tasmania, starting from Lieutenant Collins and the establishment of Hobart in 1804. He said, and you'll go to beautiful Anglesey Barracks, which is this gorgeous Georgian sandstone barracks, established in 1813, right in the middle of Hobart. Well, I couldn't knock that back. But as you might imagine, for a rack, And for a place like Tassie, where they weren't used to having women commanders, it came as a little shock to many people. But I was very fortunate that two of the former male commanders just took me under their wing and said, "It's okay, Jan, you're with us." So after 3.5 years there, I think they got used to the fact. But it was, I was very honoured to be the first female in 200 years. And at the time of Tasmania's bicentenary, we were able to hold a military tattoo, and it was my great honour to have the now Governor-General, Sir Peter Cosgrove, when he was Chief of Defence Force, he came down and attended our military tattoo for the 200 years bicentenary of Tasmania. The role had a range of responsibilities, and one of those was getting out and talking to the community, and they were always interested in this story of my background. So I have told this story many times. That role, as I said, was 3.5 years, and then an opportunity came for me to take a United Nations posting to East Timor as the Deputy Chief of the Military Liaison Group. It came in 2006, just after some more troubles. You might recall Australia went into East Timor in 1999, and things settled down over a number of years after Indonesia was pulled out of East Timor. But Indonesian troops, I should say, were pulled out of East Timor. But in about 2006, the East Timorese police and the East Timorese military were at loggerheads, and there were some issues. And there were some, unfortunately, there were some tragedies and some people killed. And so we decided as a country that we needed to send troops back into East Timor to help the East Timorese just have some control for their country. So an opportunity came to go as the deputy commander. And in doing that, I had 33 unarmed peacekeepers from Southeast Asia, Brazil, Portugal, New Zealand and Australia working for me. And that was a great opportunity for 12 months to put into place four security teams all around East Timor, and to just monitor the security under the UN-sanctioned peacekeeping deal. East Timor at the time was a little bit in poor state. A lot of the buildings were very poor, and they had really only just started to understand, with the money that they received from the Sunrise gas fields, that they were actually a rich country, but they really didn't know how to spend that money. I was very honoured, though, because I was able to sit in on some meetings with Ramos Horta, the Prime Minister at the time, and Xanana Gusmão, the President. These two men are very much the beginnings of East Timor and what it is going to be as a country into the future. At the end of my time in East Timor, around 28 years, my service in the military came to an end. And at that point, I didn't think that I'd have very much more to do with the military. But as it turned out, a role that I had seen while I was in Tasmania, the Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Affairs, came available, and I applied and was successful. So for the last 8 years, it's been my great honour to serve the veterans and the former serving members of Tasmania who've had injuries as a result of their service, to make sure that they get the best available medical care and support in terms of rehabilitation and any compensation that's due to them. This meant that I've been able to keep in touch with many of the organisations that I had dealings with in my role as military commander in Tasmania. And so I was able to step reasonably seamlessly into that role. Thanks to my military background, it certainly helped me to understand what the veterans had been through. And with my roles in looking out for their pay cases, I could understand many of the different jobs that they performed in their time in the military. And it wasn't just the serving members, but also their families that we've been able to look after as well. It continues to be a challenging time for the Department of Veterans Affairs, and mental health is one of the biggest challenges that we are facing at the moment. And I know that the department has a lot of plans in place for improving mental health and working with the Australian Department of Defence to improve the mental health of our veterans. 8 years as the Deputy Commissioner is a fairly long time with the responsibilities, because they are not just your day-to-day responsibilities, but you're also attending many weekend events and representational functions, wreath laying, etc., and giving presentations. So not so long ago, I called it quits and have, for the moment, retired. I guess that's a potted history of my military career. Thank you for listening.
What a career. What an absolutely marvellous career.
Oh, I'm sure there are lots of better ones, but, well, you know, it's been a good sort of variety of things that I've done, Helen.
Mm.
It's quite difficult to speak like that when you haven't got an audience.
You've done well then. Thank you very much, Jan.
That's all right, Helen.
Bye-bye.
Take care now.
You too.
Bye.